It's Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances and save an additional $1,000 when you buy four select LG major appliances. Plus, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 5-amp-hour battery when you buy a select DeWalt 20-volt max tool. Get the job done for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for more details and qualifying items.
Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
The most satisfying race I ever had was the 1960 French Grand Prix at Reims, where we downed the Ferrari team. People said that there was no way we could beat the Ferrari V6s with a low-line Cooper because it's a very fast circuit. It was their track and there was no way we were going to win. I had other ideas. These are the words of the late F1 legend Jack Brabham describing his thoughts on the 1960 French Grand Prix, which he won for Cooper. This pick, which the triple world champion selected for his Race of My Life to Autosport magazine in 2009, is the latest in our Race of My Life podcast series. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor, and with me today is Autosport's chief editor, Kevin Turner. How are you, Kev?
Very good, thank you. Yes, I'm looking forward to this. Another old one, which I'm sure you're going to mention at some point, so I thought I'd get it in early.
It's your favourite thing, and also you've done a feature of Jack Brabham's top 10 races already, so you're the perfect person to ask about this.
Yes, I read his autobiography that he did just after he retired. When the Flag Drops, I would recommend it. It's one of the best driver autobiographies. It's an interesting one, actually. He's got a slightly different take on racing to a lot of drivers because of his technical and engineering background, so it's definitely worth the read. But he does throughout drop the odd hint here or there as to the races he thinks were worth mentioning, because he's not one of these people that went through it race by race. Some autobiographers are just, oh, and then we went to Silverstone and I did this and then we went somewhere else. His isn't like that. So yeah, you have to look a bit harder for the gems in there.
Oh, that's good. I mean, just sorry to get sidetracked ever so slightly very early on, but I do appreciate a sporting autobiography in particular that doesn't go chronologically. I just think they just make better better reading.
Yeah, sort of. Sometimes if you go by topic or good anecdote, I think you do need something to tie it together. And obviously, chronology is the easiest thing. But yeah, you don't want to. Yeah, you don't really necessarily need a blow by blow account. You want the interesting, and he doesn't fall into that trap. So
I see. For any listeners wondering, I recommend Alistair Cook, the former England cricket captain's autobiography. It's very good for a non-chronological sporting autobiography. But anyway, as I said, wildly sidetracked. Let's get back to the 1960 French Grand Prix at Reims. It was the sixth out of 10 races that year, including the Indy 500, one of the anomalous races at the start of the Formula One World Championship. Brabham had been on 0 points until the fourth race at Zandvoort, which he won. And he then went on to win five in a row, including this race at Reims, which was the third of those five. So, I mean, it was a pivotal run, wasn't it, that brought him the second world title?
Yeah, so I think they realised at the start of the season, the very first race at the old T51 Cooper that he'd won the world championship in the year before, was going to get overtaken by the new cars, in particular Colin Chapman's Lotus 18, which is the first Formula One Lotus which worked, basically. So that was key, bringing the T53 low line in, which is actually a much nicer looking car as well. And the other thing that was really important for Brabham's title push was Stirling Moss having a wheel fall off his Lotus at Spa and put him in hospital for a while. And he missed some races, during which, you know, Brabham cleaned up. I'm not saying that Brabham wouldn't have won the championship anyway, but because he was such already on good form. But it made it pretty easy, because that left his other, the rivalry in this particular race that we're going to be talking about, Ferrari, which had an increasingly outdated piece of machinery in the team.
Indeed, I think we'll come on to discuss that increasingly outdated bit of machinery, because it's quite key when you look at the results of this race. But it's basically a three-way fight between Brabham and the two Ferraris.
Yeah, and in particular, Phil Hill. So Phil Hill, Wolfgang Von Trips. And I think the one sort of, was he under the most pressure? I think Phil Hill certainly was sort of had the bit between his teeth that day. And it was expected, one of the reasons that Jack, I think, picked this race out, is because it was one of the last circuits, very high speed circuits, basically like a sort of a huge sort of triangle, really. It's got two tight corners, but the rest of it's either straight or very fast curves. And it was sort of regarded as one of the last circuits where the front engined but more powerful Ferrari Dinos would be able to beat the Coupers and the Lotuses. And I think that Brabham rather liked the idea of playing playing the underdog.
Yeah, you can sort of sense that in his words at the start where I introduced it. It was like, oh, they're expecting to dominate. Well, we'll see about that. We'll see about that. I mean, it was only really a three-way fight for half the race, though, because there were different moments where Brabham was good and able to get away, and then Hill would come back at him. It wasn't quite a start to finish battle because gearbox drama strikes the two Ferraris.
Yeah, so I think Brabham picked it up partly because, well, it was a great fight up to that point. And then, of course, he's the one that comes out on top. I mean, there's a key moment in the race where, very, very basically, the Ferrari would have had more straight line speed, but the Cooper could have got into its toe and also had a much lower frontal area. So Brabham said he was actually able to still, even at high speed, pull out and go past before the braking area. Because it would have been, if you looked at the fronts of the two cars, you'd see the Cooper's much smaller, I think. And obviously it was better under braking as well. And Phil Hill at one point just gets a bit carried away and tries to outbrake Brabham in the Cooper, locks up and goes skating past him. And Brabham actually says, "It's very lucky that I happened to just check at that moment, because if I'd turned in, they'd have crashed and they'd have probably both been out." But I think that's the beginning of the end, if you like. You know, Brabham knows that he's got it then, and yeah, obviously both Ferraris fail, and he's left well clear. And I think it was a Cooper 1-2-3-4 in the end. So it was a rout at a circuit that Ferrari would have gone thinking, yeah, we've got a good chance here.
It certainly was. He wins in the end by 48.3 seconds. And yes, as you said, Cooper Climax 1-2-3-4. But interestingly, Climax engines in the back of the top eight finishers. And in your feature assessing Brabham's top 10 races, you described this race as the age of the front engine F1 car was over, which is quite a powerful statement there. But, you know,
that's a bit dramatic, isn't it? Yeah. Well, in 1959, the Ferraris had been competitive. Tony Brooks had been in the championship fight to the very end with Brabham and Stirling Moss in the privateer, Rob Walker Cooper. But 1960, they really weren't competitive at most circuits. And the Ferrari was still the best front engine Grand Prix car. You give a shout out to the four-wheel drive Ferguson, but it never really did anything world championship races. It won a non-championship race at Alton Park. But so the Ferrari was really the last front-running, front-engined car. And that was really the last opportunity for it. They did win. Phil Hill's first Grand Prix win actually was at Monza, but that was a race where all the British teams boycotted it because of the banking. Cynics would have suggested they knew that they were going to get beaten there anyway. But yeah, in terms of a proper fight with a full grid of Grand Prix cars, that was probably the last chance that the front engine cars had to make an impact. And when Cooper beat them there as well, that was it. I mean, by then Ferrari was already developing the shark nose for the following year anyway. So, yeah, it was the last hurrah, really, 1960 for the front engine Grand Prix car.
Indeed, and obviously as we said, it was quite a run that Brabham was on. He goes on to win two more races in his streak. But this is the first time by winning at Reims, he shares the championship lead with Bruce McLaren on 24 points. And then when he wins at the next race in Portugal, he takes a lead that he doesn't lose, and he goes on to take his second world title.
Yeah, it was quite a dominant one in the end, really. And I think on that. On that race, it was quite probably the year before, the Ferrari team had been correct. Tony Brooks had dominated the race, and the Coopers hadn't quite managed to do it. So this was, yeah, that was another, just going back to that was the sign that even on a high speed circuit, you needed the engine behind the driver. But yeah, in terms of a championship fight, there wasn't really one. Moss was competitive when he came back. The Ferraris weren't competitive. And I think, you know, Jack Brabham was always going to beat Bruce McLaren across the season. The championship fight wasn't there, but obviously he enjoyed that particular race. Although he did in his Race of My Life, I'm going to admit to changing the copy for the version that's gone up on autosport.com, is that he claims that he hit 200 miles an hour in the T53, and I'm pretty sure if you with other researchers, I think that may be memory playing tricks. I'm pretty sure that it wouldn't have been able to do 200 miles an hour, even pulling out the toe of the Ferrari. So, yeah, I did take that out because I thought that needs to be verified before that can go in.
Autosport editor disagrees with F1 legend. Interesting there, Kev. Bold, I would say. Well, there we go. I mean, just very quickly on that title battle, it's interesting. There's a great reference book that I know you have as well, Kev, which is on the looks at the first, it sort of ranks the first 1,000 races of the Formula One World Championships. Very good book. I do recommend it. I think we should plug that for Roger Smith because he's really helped me out with these Race of My Life podcasts.
It's a very useful book. I've written about it before in pieces as well. Mm. Yes.
But anyway, just interesting is that there's a graph, a points graph at the start of every season charting how the title fight plays out. What's interesting about this one is that Brabham is on zero for so long and then just shoots through into the lead that he never loses.
Yeah, it's just one of those seasons that didn't get going for him. And then I think that potential was always going to be there. Once, I mean, I think it was on the flight home from Argentina where John Cooper and Jack Brabham.
That's a long flight, I can tell you.
Yes, had a conversation about what they were going to do, and the result was the T53. And I think that the moment that car came out, obviously it needed to be sorted out and made reliable, etc., etc. But once he was up and running, and I say when Moss was out of the equation, it was kind of one-way traffic, really.
Absolutely. Well, let's hear again the words of Jack Brabham from his Race of My Life feature, which, as Kev said, you can read in autosport.com, and then we'll assess what other races he might have picked for his Race of My Life. To win was fantastic. I got a lot of satisfaction out of it, and it was my third win in a row on the way to the 1960 title. Fairly summing up what we'd already gone over there with Jack Brabham, but there we go. Now let's move on to basically your feature, Kev, the top 10 races that of Jack Brabham's career. We'll start with a race I think you put as number one above the 1960 French Grand Prix at Reims, which is the 1966 German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, where Brabham qualifies fifth and ends up winning. He calls it a shocking race, very dangerous in the wet conditions. To the point where he asked to get extra grooves cut into his tyres to help clear the water out of the way. And it's just quite an epic battle between him and John Surtees.
Yeah, you summed up well why I put it at the top of the list. For me, the extra treads cut into it, I like, because that's very Jack Brabham. That's very making sure you've got everything maximised before you started. You know, he's very good at me. He knew when he had a good package. And I think he's one of those drivers that rose to the occasion when he knew he had something good. You know, he pretty much admits that actually in his book that, you know, if he knew things were together, then he could fight at the front. But I don't think he was someone to drag a mediocre car high up the field. But he, you know, the 1966 season was a shambles for lots of teams, and but it wasn't for Brabham. They got the Brabham Repco, was a good package which Jack was key in putting together. And then he got those extra treads because of the rain at the Nürburgring. And of course, we've got the Nürburgring factor again. We've talked about this a lot of times. I don't think it's a coincidence that the circuit comes up so often in people's Race of My Lives or in our discussions about what they should have picked. It was a fight for most of the race with John Surtees in the Cooper. And Surtees was magnificent around Nürburgring. His own Race of My Life was the 63 German Grand Prix there. He won the Nürburgring 1000 kilometres there. He was very good. And you would probably say he was better at Nürburgring than Jack. Brabham's record there wasn't as good. The first time he'd been in a major race there, I think, was at 58,000 kilometres sharing with Moss in an Aston Martin, and had sort of lost so much ground. Moss basically had to do virtually the whole race himself to make sure they won. So that shows you how far he'd come in the subsequent years to be able to go toe-to-toe with Surtees and basically have the upper hand. In the end, Surtees has a problem with a few laps to go. I think he has a clutch problem, which means he falls away. But Brabham, you know, didn't look like losing it anyway. It's just a shame that you didn't get that absolute right to the end, you know, win a 15 lap race at the Nürburgring by a second and a half or something would have been great. But he picked it out in his autobiography as being one of those special moments, and I think any win at the Nürburgring is going to be up there. I'm sure he would have had to do more driving, if you like, on that day than he did at Reims, which was more about racecraft and being in the toe of the Ferrari. So sort of a slightly different challenge of driving.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's interesting, you know, in your top 10 feature that just to how far ahead that they even, because he's got a big winning margin because of Surtees' issue, but the rest of the field, the third place finisher, is over, well over 2 minutes behind Surtees, so they're well clear.
Yeah, and the third place finisher is Jochen Rindt. I mean, it's not, we're not talking about make weight, you know, as a future world champion, and he's 2.5 minutes behind. So yeah, it's one of those epic circuits, and the great drivers seem to have at least one epic Nordschleife performance in them somewhere, and that was Brabham's.
Absolutely. Well, behind that, in your top 10, behind the 1966 German Grand Prix, you obviously did rank the 1960 French Grand Prix, and below that is the 1970 British Grand Prix at Brands Hatch, where you say he loses the race twice. How does he do that?
Yes. So this, he described this as one of the biggest, if not the biggest, disappointments of his career. So bearing in mind that he's 44 at this point, he's been around for a decade and a half. A lot of people would have thought he was past his best. He probably was past his best, but again, he knew coming into 1970 that the car was going to be good. It was the first monocoque Brabham Grand Prix car, BT33, and he hadn't been able to hold it. He wanted to get Jochen Rindt back at Brabham, then he was going to retire, but that didn't work out. Colin Chapman held on to Rindt at Lotus, so he's like, oh, all right, then another year, here we go. And he and the car were competitive at the start of the season. He won in South Africa, and there's a great race at Brands Hatch where he basically is in a duel with Rindt in the Lotus 72. So rising star in a revolutionary car that's going to be winning Grand Prix 4 years later. He's tied to its gearbox, because Rindt has gone past him earlier on in a nice move. There's a picture of it, actually. There's not much room at all for Rindt to get his car through at Paddock Hill Bend. And he stays with him, eventually gets a run on him. I think Rindt misses a gear. Brabham goes into the lead, disappears. He's beaten him. He's got it all won, and then he runs out of fuel on the very last lap. At the very last couple of corners of the very last lap, and he rolls over the line in second place. So that's the first time he loses the race. And then the second time is that it's somebody spots that the Lotus's rear wing is too high for the regulations. Brabham's quite funny about that in his accounts of it, because he says as soon as Colin Chapman goes in to see the stewards, he knows that Rindt's going to get the win back. And he said, I don't really want to win like that anyway. But yeah, it looked like he was going to get the win back because the Lotus was going to be disqualified. But I think, I don't know how hypocritical or otherwise it is, but the story goes that some Lotus mechanics may have leaned on the struts of the rear wing so that it was bent enough to be the correct height. And then they had an argument about, oh, you've come up with so many different measurements, how can you be sure? All right, then, yeah, you can have the win. So probably not the sort of argument you'd have now. I don't think that the FIA would let you get away with that sort of thing anymore. But
no, I'm not sure leaning on rear wings is ever really allowed, let's face it.
Yeah.
Just at any point, just not a good idea. Just think how much money that would cost if you broke it.
Yeah, I mean, Brabham is quite clear that he didn't want to win it that way. Yeah, the reason he was so gutted was because he'd done all the hard work on track. He had got Rindt beaten, and then it was taken away from him. Because of running out of fuel. Again, there are a couple of different accounts as to why that is. But basically, he felt that the car was running slightly too rich, the settings, and that he'd run out of fuel. So, yeah, that was a big disappointment, but a fantastic drive for a veteran against the rising star, who obviously, well, he's already a star, isn't really. He's on his way to winning his world championship.
Absolutely. It's certainly a galling defeat, or two defeats in that race. Now, the next race on your list is actually an F2 race. It's not a Formula One World Championship race. The 1964 Alton Park Gold Cup, which Brabham wins for Brabham. How did that go down, and why is that so high up on your list?
It's basically high up on the list because he beats Jim Clark in a straight fight. I think in the past we talked about, if you look at who finished second in a race, that gives you some idea. John Surtees, his choice was the only Grand Prix Clark ever finished second in, so he's we quite like that fact when we talked about the Surtees one. And this is an F2 race at Alton Park, as you say. Gold Cup switched from the F1 to F2, and there's a four car fight early on. Three Brabhams, Graham Hill, Denny Holman, Jack Brabham, and Jim Clark in a Lotus, and they're swapping positions. It must have been a fantastic race to watch. And eventually, but it sort of boils down to a Brabham versus Clark fighting. Clark's hounding Brabham. Brabham's a very difficult guy to pass in days where overtaking was supposed to be easier. He was sort of renowned for it. And but Clark finds a way through, got a way through, and then Brabham immediately repassed him, and they just kept it up all the way to the very end, and he won by 0.2 of a second on the line. So, you know, great driver's track against, you know, against, you know, one of the all-time greats. I think the reason I didn't put it any higher wasn't actually because it was an F2 race. It was more because the reading the contemporary reports, you do get the feeling that Clark is probably driving with a slight car disadvantage. Brabham's probably got the slightly better car, and Clark's kind of making up for it with his sort of with his driving, so it evens it out slightly. But even so, to have that, he was, I think he was a great battler, Brabham, and that was a great example of you know, not cracking under pressure from, you know, one of the absolute top liners of the era.
I mean, Brabham does have that sort of hard man reputation in sort of on and off the track, really. Would that be fair to say?
I think he was fair. I think people liked him off the track. But on the track, he was, yeah, he'd be what sort of Stirling Moss would call a racer. Yeah, he wasn't someone that if you came past him, they'd be psychologically broken and that was it. You'd beaten them. You had to make sure you had him beaten. Yeah, because he was sort of a never say die attitude. Look at how long his career was. You know, he started off in little, well, in terms of the world championship, in small engined, you know, rear engine Coopers, and then he's, you know, he's still winning races in the DFV era with basically slicks and wings. So, yeah, adaptable and dogged and pragmatic and all those things that people have said about him. Almost Brabham cliches, really.
Indeed. I mean, racer in that context from Stirling Moss is almost a backhanded compliment. It means feisty, right? That's what he actually means.
I don't think Stirling would have seen it as a backhanded compliment. He saw drivers as being either drivers or racers, and he had certainly a lot more time for racers than he did drivers. But yeah, I mean, Brabham did occasionally get accused of, you know, he was known for flicking stones and things up at his rivals. Yeah, how deliberate it was. He certainly was a canny and wily character. Let's put it that way. You had to work hard to beat him, I think. And Clark worked hard that day at Alton Park but failed.
Indeed. Well, for the next pick, we jump back to the 1970 Formula One season. It's the South African Grand Prix at Kyalami. Brabham goes from third to first to win. What can you tell us about that race and why was that so high up?
Well, I'm in two minds about it. In that it does make me wonder how good the BT33 was, which was good partly because of Jack's work, so, you know, fair enough. But yeah, he doesn't have a very good getaway. I think his getaway is okay, but he then gets sort of involved in a first corner incident, and he was a safe drive, didn't take unnecessary risks. In fact, that's why I didn't like driving for him, because he was convinced that Brabham would make sure everything was screwed together properly, which certain other teams of the era maybe weren't quite so good on. And he does a couple of slow laps to make sure nothing's going to fall off, and then he gets on with it. And he charges through the field, I think sixth, passes everyone, gets up in second, 6 second gap to Jackie Stewart in the lead, catches him, passes him, wins the race. Thank you very much. So there aren't many people that close down Jackie Stewart to pass him to win a Grand Prix. That didn't happen very often. The caveat to this one is I'm pretty convinced that Stewart's probably only in the lead because of Stewart, as opposed to the March 701, which I don't think was a particularly fabulous. It was a very good first F1 car for a new constructor, but I think it probably wasn't that superb. But yeah, again, aging. And Brabham hadn't won a World Championship Grand Prix for a while as well, so he'd certainly been considered past his best by then. But that really was a taste of what was to come in 1970, where a lot of races where Brabham was a real contender for the race wins.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to jump back for your next point, back to 1964, the Aintree 200. What can you tell us about that race? And why is it you're particularly obsessed with 1964 and 1970?
that's just where the reports and the accounts led me, Alex.
I see.
Well, I actually had the good fortune of doing a podcast on Jack Brabham with Ian Titchmarsh a year or two ago. And this was a race that he said I probably should have put number one. It was his push for, or I certainly thought I should have put it higher, because it was a non-championship Formula One race at Aintree. I would put in there that the caveat is that Ian was there, and he always tends to rate the races he was at, which is fair enough. There are an awful lot of them, so fair play to him. But so it becomes a Clark versus Brabham fight. Brabham has the lead early on. Clark catches him. Neither of them were on pole. Graham Hill was on pole, but they both quicker than him in the race. And Clark gets ahead of Brabham and tries to pull away and really cranks up the pace. And Brabham goes with him. It's like what I was saying before about just not giving in, just fights, and actually gets back ahead, which turns out to be crucial when they come to Melling Crossing, which is a famous part of the circuit. Clark catches the backmark in the wrong place and ends up having a crash. Now, a number of times that Clark crashed out of a race, you could definitely do it on one hand. Brabham basically forced the issue. I was ahead of him already, even at the point of crashing, so it wasn't like he inherited the win at that point. So again, there's another example of going toe-to-toe with the era's benchmark and coming out on top.
The next race is also a non-championship Formula One race, the 1969 BRDC International Trophy at Silverstone, which Brabham wins on pole position as well. How did that one go down?
So this was a wet race, and Brabham's probably not one of those drivers that immediately comes to mind when you're talking about great wet weather drivers. But actually, he was very good in the wet, certainly a lot better than Denny Holm, who was his teammate at Brabham for a couple of years in F1 and F2. And his team on this occasion is Jackie Ickx, who, as we've discussed before, Alex, is a wet weather meister. Like half of his 10 races that he picked out to us, or to Gary Watkins, were wet weather races. He was superb in the wet, but in the same car, he has a fight with... Ickx has a fight with Frank Williams, Ron Brabham, for second, and they're miles behind Jack. Jack just clears off. And it probably wouldn't be that remarkable a race had it not been for the fact that Jochen Rindt also puts in one of his special drives. He has a problem early on that clears, and he comes charging through the field in the way that he sometimes got in sort of second half of races like Monaco 1970 as well. And he's closing. Brabham responds, all looks under control. Rindt's closing, but he's not going to make it. And then Brabham runs out of fuel again. But this time, instead of coasting across the line in second after Rindt's gone past, he coasts across the line with a dead engine before Rindt arrives. So it's basically the same kind of story, but this time with a happier ending.
So Rindt would no doubt look back at the 1970 British Grand Prix as being a poetic justice for reversing that fortune.
Well, perhaps, as I say, they were quite good friends. Rindt liked Brabham a lot, and he thought seriously. I've been doing some work about Jochen Rindt because it's 50 years this year since he won his championship, and then was obviously unfortunately killed at Monza. And he really did seriously consider going back to Brabham for 1970, but he felt that he had a better chance of winning the world championship with Lotus, and Colin Chapman could offer him a lot more money than Jack Brabham could. I doubt he'd have begrudged Brabham. I can imagine Rindt sort of being almost of the opinion, well, if I've won because you've run out of fuel, that should have been your win anyway. I think they were both quite magnanimous in that way.
Fair enough. I look forward to reading your work, as I always do, but particularly something is no doubt well researched as your work on.
I spent a long time on the Rindt one, I must admit. We've had a slight. I started at the end of last year, and obviously I've had to put that research to one side because of other things that have been going on in 2020. So hopefully I'll come back to it as racing resumes.
Absolutely. Well, the next race is a really interesting one. This back in 1960, the New Zealand Grand Prix at Ardmore. Brabham goes from 24th on the grid to win. So it's obviously quite a race, but probably a bit more to it than that.
Well, I partly wanted to put... partly because it's another one of these slightly obscure non-championship F1 races, which is you've probably worked out by now I quite like.
And it's also less obvious. It's also got Stirling Moss involved in it. So that's also why you like it.
Yes. Well, this ticks two boxes, really, got it onto the list. One is that he goes from 24th to 3rd on lap one. Now, I want to see that lap. I want the onboard of that lap. Obviously, it doesn't exist. But even if you say that the rest of the field, I think that obviously the quality of the field was not of a World Championship Grand Prix level. But nevertheless, that's incredible progress. So that kind of got my attention when I was sort of looking through all these races. But the reason it got onto the list was because he then has a duel with Moss. And it's very difficult to call who's going to win it until Moss's car breaks. So and then actually towards the end, Brabham's own engine is incredibly hot, and he almost gets caught by Bruce McLaren. So it's got a bit of everything. It's got an incredible start from I would call it one of the charges that you like, Alex. Except I don't know whether if you've done all the charging one lap, it's not sure whether it ticks that box or not, really. But then it's, yeah, so he's got the charge from the back, great fight for the lead with one of the great drivers, and then a dramatic just holding on as the car falls to pieces around him across the line. So, yeah, quite a fun race, I thought.
Well, what I like about this, because as you say, I have said many times before on this podcast how much I love a charging drive, is the fact that he goes from 24th to win. It's not like he goes from, okay, say 24th, finishes 5th. That's still a fine effort. He just goes the whole way, and he's so far down. And yeah, what that first lap must have been incredible. I think with the accolade of Ayrton Senna at Donington in 93, this has got to rival it. Okay, not a world championship race, but...
I would like
tongue in cheek there, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, I think the quality of that field did fall away quite a lot after the first three or four cars. But even so, just finding the room, apparently he put his car at an angle at the back on the back row. So I'm going that way, even if it's on the grass, I'm going that way to get past them. But yeah, obviously worked.
Absolutely. Well, the next one, we're going to discuss two more races that the USS into Brabham's top 10 races. And this one is the 1959 Monaco Grand Prix, which Brabham wins again for Cooper.
Yeah, so he felt conflicted about this because in his own, actually it wasn't his autobiography, he actually had a book published in 1960 called Jack Brabham's Motor Racing Book, which is fabulous. And in that, he
I can imagine you being given that as a child,
I did actually buy that in adulthood, but yes, that's probably fair. Yeah, that is the sort of random book that I would have been clinging to as a schoolboy. Yeah. So in that, he criticizes his own driving in that, but then Adrian Ball, which I've mentioned a couple of times, he edited a book for the Jim Clark Foundation in 1974 called My Greatest Race. So clearly we've stolen that idea. And Brabham picks the 59 Monaco Grand Prix, so he's conflicted about it. The reason being that obviously it's a very important race in terms of milestone. If you're picking the emotional importance of a race, this is his first world championship win, and it's the Monaco Grand Prix, so clearly it's going to tick that box. The reason that he was critical of it is that he basically let Stirling Moss get way too far out front. He'd had some reliability problems the previous race, was worried about overheating, so when the two of them and Jean Beres Ferrari go off at the start, both of them get past the Ferrari, and then Moss clears off. Brabham's a bit, and doesn't go for it. And Moss has a minute's lead. And then the car breaks. But Brabham kind of said, there's no way you're going to take a minute out of Stirling Moss, basically. So he kind of felt like he'd given the race away unnecessarily. It kind of popped back on the list for me when Brooks then challenges him towards the end, and Brabham speeds up and then laps faster than anyone, including Moss, has gone previously on an oily track. So he could do it. It was kind of almost proof that he had perhaps thought himself out of it earlier on in the race, but kind of got himself together and then won. And sort of just to finish it off, in as often happened in those days, something was wrong. His pedals were incredibly hot from the radiator. So, he was virtually burning his feet driving around as well. So another one of these races with lots of stuff going on.
Indeed. And do you think that sort of chimes with what you were saying at the beginning about him needing things to be pretty perfect for that to happen? But that extends to that race to, he needed the challenge later on from Brooks to get him into that zone of everything's good, so I can lap as fast as I can here.
Yeah, possibly. He certainly says, and not just in relation to that race, he says that there are certain events I probably didn't win that I might have done had I known less about the machinery, because he knew so much and was so invested in it, and that was one of his great strengths. So he won 3 world championships because of that strength. But he said there were also days where I was probably thinking about the engine temperature, the oil temperature, the brakes, the whatever it was, instead of just getting on with it and doing the job. But I think as you say, when there's a sniff of victory, this is true of all the great drivers, however they come to it, if there's a sniff of victory, then they're in the zone, aren't they? Fernando Alonso is like that as well. He's kind of the epitome for me of, if there's a half a chance, he just, something happens. And I think, there's no way, having made that what he considered to be error to let Moss get that far ahead, to then be given the lead, he wasn't going to let Brooks come and nick it from him at the end.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, let's come to the last race we're going to discuss on this list. It's the 1961 Indy 500, which is not a race that Brabham wins, but it's his performance here that it does do so well, and it's so significant later on for another Formula One driver that is successful at Indy.
Yeah, so he finished ninth, but he should have finished fifth or sixth, which I think sounds pretty impressive on your Indy 500 debut. Not many people manage that. So yeah, Cooper were having a pretty terrible F1 season. Anyone that wasn't Ferrari or Stirling Moss was having a pretty terrible season, 61 really. So they decided to go and give Indy 500 a try, a slightly bigger Climax engine. It was really a modified F1 car, really, with sort of slightly different tyres from Dunlop, bigger Climax engine. And he went out there, and I think to start with, he found it quite overwhelming. He's in the middle of the pack. The front engine roadsters were much faster in a straight line, and he, to start with, couldn't find a way. Yeah, anyone that's been in a GT3 race for the equalisation, you always want the car, if the lap time's the same, you want the car with the power, because that's the one that's going to get you the overtaking done. And he didn't have that, but eventually he worked out ways. He got more comfortable having those cars around him, because remember, quite different kind of scenarios to what he was used to, that he started picking them off. And actually, he would have finished much higher had it not been for the fact that he just had two big tyre wear. Dunlops weren't quite up to it, whereas Firestone had more experience at Indy, so the Roadsters, despite being heavier, didn't need quite the same amount of number of stops. So it was a good demonstration of his adaptability. What I found really interesting was that he came away from it thinking that a mid-engine car wasn't the thing to have for Indy, because it wouldn't be able to take the bigger engines required to be quick there. Obviously, that proved to be not the case within a couple of years when Jim Clark and Lotus went over there. But yeah, I included it partly because it shows his adaptability, and partly because it's an easily forgotten race in Brabham's and in Indy history, really, because everyone always thinks about Jim Clark and Graham Hill going over there and winning it.
Absolutely. No, certainly very worthy of inclusion. Well, we've come to the point in the episode again where we have to make a choice about whether we agree with a legendary driver. Go on,
unless you've got a favourite that jumps out at you, you've got a three-way choice here. The power you hold is even greater than normal. So you can go for mine, which is 1966 German Grand Prix, Jack Brabham's himself, 1960 French Grand Prix, or you could even go for Ian Titchmarsh's 1964 Aintree 200.
For all of the reasons we've discussed on Race of My Life before, I am going to go with your pick, the 1966.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't
German
sure whether you
Grand
would.
Prix.
I really wasn't sure.
I think it's the Nürburgring factor, and it's the fact that he beat Surtees. Okay, he has a problem late on, but he doesn't look like he's going to lose the race, who, as you say, was a Nürburgring specialist. And yeah, that edges it for me, I think. Yeah. Sorry, Ian, if you're listening.
I like it because it also, and I know this isn't necessarily the reason you'd pick the number one, but I like it because it brings together a lot of things that are good about Brabham. So the car is competitive and one of the best cars on the grid because of the work that he's done and been pragmatic with Repco to get the engine. Then he's done the extra treads, the extra cuts in the tyres, because he wants to make sure it clears that water that little bit better. And then also, you've got to drive it. It's the Nürburgring, and he's done it as well as anyone, with John Surtees there. So it shows him, I think, all his attributes off nicely. And of course, on his way to his third world championship as well. So yeah, I'm pleased that you've agreed, but I wasn't expecting that you would.
No. And there was certainly no pressure was exerted on me to take Kev's pick there. I just think that, maybe this is being too simplistic, but the fact that the Ferraris drop out at Reims in 1960 doesn't devalue it as a race, but it was like, it's not like, they're gone quite early on in the race. It's lap 31 and sort of, do you know what I mean? Like that sort of.
I think, yeah. And I think also, he picks it because it's kind of a milestone one. It was a kind of a, we're hoping that hopefully we can do Alan Jones one at some point, and his pick is very much a sort of an up yours given the situation that's happening. And I kind of feel like Jack Brabham's choice is a bit similar, whereas I think probably the best drive was probably the Nürburgring, or even maybe one of the 1970 races.
Which I do appreciate. It's really lovely doing this podcast, because you just get a different sense of why these great drivers have picked these different races. And it's, when we talk about, the 1966 German Grand Prix is number one and 1960 Reims is number two, we're not exactly saying, it's not saying that one was good and one was bad. It's like, these are all brilliant. It's just this just for certain specific reasons, that just edges it ahead because it's also fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hopefully this will encourage people to go and, you know, read reports or watch old footage or whatever or something, because there are a lot of fantastic races out there which obviously when you're going on to the next weekend and, you know, all the stuff that's happening now, you can get forgotten. But obviously the last few months, for reasons obviously we'd rather didn't happen, we've had a bit of a chance to look back at, you know, some of these great races, and I think it's worth doing.
Absolutely. I mean, when you mentioned, we were talking about the 1916 British Grand Prix earlier, and Rinton and Brabham and that overtake at Paddock Hill Bend, it sent me straight back to national races I'd covered there, and I'd not known that. You know, you can go to these places and just think of the history and the famous drives and the famous people that have been there. So yeah, when we are all allowed out to do as we please, as we all hope, you know, I would recommend everyone gets down to a racetrack and see something going on.
And Brands Hatch still does have, not only does it have racing, it still hosts historic F1 cars. So yeah, have a look at the MSV website and find when the meetings are on.
Absolutely. Well, before you do that, go to autosport.com and read Jack Brabham's Race of My Life feature. Kev, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Lovely. Always good to have you. And we'll be back soon with another episode of the Race of My Life podcast.
Love espresso, drip coffee, and cold brew? With the Ninja Luxe Cafe, if you can crave it, you can brew it. Espresso? Balanced. Drip coffee? Rich. Cold brew? In a flash. With Barista Assist technology, you brew with no stress and no guesswork. And make perfect silky microfoam hands-free from dairy or plant-based milks. Bring the coffee house home and unlock your favorites with the Ninja Luxe Cafe.